What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Dune Not Enter podcast, where today, when it comes to spice, the enemy of your enemy isn't your friend. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
Hey, guys.
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. And today we will be going through chapter 29 of Dune. But before that, we can go through what's happened this week. So anything new y'all want to share?
I just wanted to say that this is actually our second recording because yesterday we ran into some technical difficulties, particularly on my end because I had like a massive 3-second delay.
And yeah, like that was crazy. I was so confused. So we were doing our normal recording and we realized, you know, Nolan seemed to be really slow. So yeah.
Fortunately, we figured out the problem.
Yeah,
he just had to switch
computers, but that was really interesting. Haven't ever had that happen, but probably just some Wi-Fi issue. But it's nice we got through that. So here's take two, and should be better.
I hope so.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is the last week of our summer, so that's a little bittersweet, but.
I couldn't even wake up on time today. I don't know if I'm going to wake up tomorrow.
Yeah, same. I keep waking up at 8 and then turning off my alarm and then waking up at 9.
Like, I don't know. Tomorrow I have to wake up at 6 or something.
I have to get up at 6:45 or something.
I've never woken up that early this entire summer.
This whole summer I've been getting up at 8, so... Oh, no, it's...
Mine's even later than that.
Oh, no. Yeah, so it's going to be quite the adjustment, but... it should be, you know, it's our last year, so I'm somehow still a little bit excited.
And then once I get to college, I'm going to screw up my sleep schedule again.
never wake up, just watch the recorded lectures and waste your tuition. Yeah,
honestly.
Sounds great. Yeah, that's the college life. Alrighty. So that sounds great. So this is our last recording of the summer, but it should be the best, hopefully. We look to keep improving. But yeah, so Nolan, you can take it away with Epigraph.
Okay, so today we have one of the longest epigraphs we've ever come across in this entire book. And let me just read it to y'all. It says, "Family life of the Royal Creche is difficult for many people to understand, but I shall try to give you a capsule view of it. My father had only one real friend, I think. That was Count Hesimir Fenring, a genetic eunuch and one of the deadliest fighters in the Imperium. The Count, a dapper and ugly little man, brought a new slave concubine to my father one day, and I was dispatched by my mother to spy on the proceedings. All of us spied on my father as a matter of self-protection. When the slave concubines permitted my father under the Bene Gesserit Guild Agreement, could not, of course, bear a royal successor, but the intrigues were constant and oppressive in their similarity. We became adept, my mother and sisters and I, at avoiding subtle instruments of death. It may seem a dreadful thing to say, but I'm not at all sure my father was innocent in all these attempts. A royal family is not like other families. Here was a new slave concubine. Then, red hair like my father, willowy and graceful. She had the dancer's muscles, and her training obviously had included neural enticement. My father looked at her for a long time as she postured unclothed before him. Finally, he said, 'She is too beautiful. We will save her as a gift.' You have no idea how much consternation this restraint created in the royal creche. Subtlety and self-control were, after all, the most deadly threats to us all in my father's house by the Princess Irulan."
Wow. Yeah, so really long indeed. That took nearly a page. Definitely the longest epigraph that we've seen so far. But what do you have to say about it? It's really interesting.
I think this entire epigraph really brings like a deeper dynamic into the internal like workings of the royal family. Mm-hmm. They call themselves a royal crush, which I'm still confused on, and I don't really know why. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that this family is a lot more messed up than we think. I know initially from previous epigraphs, we kind of thought that Princess Irulan and the Emperor had a better relationship because they were talking about like, oh, Leda looks like my father, you know, my father's looking like a painting, and like, he wants me to marry, like, oh, like, Leto or something, but I'm too young or something. So
yeah,
I thought
it's
a better relationship, but I guess not, you know. I'm gonna kill him.
it's surprising because as you know, it seems like Irulan and the Emperor really had a close relationship, and it seems like they had a good father-daughter relationship, and you know, sometimes it said he was angry, sometimes it said he was, you know, sad or whatever. But I didn't realize, you know, he was trying to kill them.
I really thought they understood each other to like a different extent, but I guess not.
Yeah, it's crazy because, you know, they're spying on each other, and it's funny because her mother was the one who dispatched her to spy on her father. So I'm assuming her mother and her and Princess Irulan are closer.
Right. Yeah, I guess family feud stuff where they chose the father and the mother's sides. I don't know.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And the father, you know, is setting up assassination attempts on his own royal family. That's just, you know, that I can't imagine what the purpose is. Because from what we've seen of the emperor, I don't think he's really a rational person.
I always think of him as like a leader, like a powerful, rational thinker, similar to how Leto was in his, I guess, optimal days.
In his prime, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I also think of him as sort of cunning in a way, because he did set up the war between the Harkonnens and the Atreides.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he did, right. Yeah, so he seems like a mastermind, but now he just seems like a crazy mastermind.
A cutthroat, cunning mastermind.
A little too deep.
Right.
But I guess the reason he goes to such extents is mainly to combat whatever Bene Gesserit plan is within the Imperium, right? Because we know Princess Irulan and her mother are part of the Bene Gesserits, and they have this weird agreement that doesn't allow, I guess, the Emperor to bear a royal successor. So he tries to like loophole this through a concubine. I can't really imagine what's going on here, because I understood that like people didn't like the Bene Gesserit because, you know, everyone called them witches in this book, but I didn't know like it was so like ingrained to society that like it'll be like a royal fight against the Bene Gesserit. So I guess it's much more widespread and much more like deeply engraved in their society than we think, like the fighting between regular people and Bene Gesserits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bene Gesserits are this kind of suspicious, and a lot of different groups have called them witches. So, you know, not just one group, but a lot of different groups. Even
like,
yeah, those
everyone.
People close to those people close to Jessica, even so,
like Hawaii.
Yeah,
yeah, it's right, crazy to think that like even her closest friends still think of her in that such a way sometimes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're quite degraded. But I'm interested in what their master plan is. You know, so to not allow the emperor to bear a royal heir. Are the Bene Gesserits trying to, you know, insert their own person onto the throne perhaps and take power? I'm not sure.
And just like thinking how the emperor like in the beginning even folded such an agreement, it shows that the Bene Gesserits have like immeasurable power in this aspect to like manipulate people.
Mm-hmm.
As an emperor, I would never like bow down to like such a, I guess, proposal that I could never bear a son or like a successor for my throne.
Yeah, because you want to keep it within the family, right? But
yeah,
then you know, so there was some, you know, price that Bene Gesserit paid probably. And yeah, so that's really interesting, and so many mm-hmm. different questions to ask, and we can kind of watch out for these clues while we're reading the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. I also kind of feel like part of the Emperor's cunningness, like throughout this whole Atreides and Harkonnen aspect, may have came from his fight with the Bene Gesserit, because in order to defeat someone so powerful and so manipulative, you kind of have to like step up your own game in this department as well, or else you're gonna be like broad as daylight. They're gonna counter your every move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's basically fighting fire with fire, and he needs to incorporate his own techniques. And I'm sure he consults some Bene Gesserits that he's able to trust, although I guess it's not really possible for him to trust them at all.
Yeah.
They seem to have a tight grip on their members.
He probably consults his mentats more. I'm mm-hmm. sure the Emperor has a couple.
Oh, yeah most sure. definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we know that mentats are, I guess they're the closest thing to be able to counter the Bene Gesserit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how else he would be able to go against them.
Yeah, it depends on the specific mentat Bene Gesserit, you know, matchup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we saw Peter completely outplay the entire Atreides, even Jessica.
Jessica, we saw Jessica outplay Hawat, so,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But I mean, we know Peter is just better than Hawat at his job.
I think so. I mean, Peter has this cold, you know, kind of mindless killer.
He's next level.
Kind of, yeah, mm-hmm. he's really an assassin. I don't feel like Hawat's as assassin-y.
Yeah, yeah, he's kind of like an old grandfather.
Yeah, I was going to say old grandpa with the computer in his head. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I imagine. It's wrong because Hawat is he's a really accomplished figure, but just the way he's been presented so far, you know, it's a little demeaning to his character. Yeah.
It doesn't really impress me.
Mm-hmm. I'm not really impressed. Yeah. So cool. All right. Thank you for that. Yeah. This is, you know, hopefully we don't run into one of these page long epigraphs again. But we spent mm-hmm. A good amount of time discussing it. It's really interesting. You learn a lot about the Bene Gesserit, and especially within the royal family, all these internal tensions, right? Cool. So before we dive into the rest of the chapter, we'll do the quote section. So Fillmore, as usual, you have the first quote.
Okay, so my quote today is pretty long, so I'll just read a preview of it and finish the rest of it when we get to it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my quote goes, "How the mind gears itself for its environment," she thought. And she recalled a Bene Gesserit axiom. The mind can go either direction under stress, toward positive or toward negative, on or off.
It just sounds so much like a binary circuit.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, it's just zero and one. It's only two ways, you know. Yeah, so really interesting. I love to see Bene Gesserit axioms because I feel like they always tell you a lot, mm-hmm. even just about real life, not just about the book. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So my quote. I'll do the same thing and kind of only read some highlights, but it's a long imagery passage. So I'll just read two highlights. The first goes, "Its mouth was some 80 meters in diameter, crystal teeth with the curved shape of Chris knives glinting around the rim." So that's the first one. And continue a few sentences down, we have, "The worm drew back under the sand, lay there momentarily, its crystal teeth weaving moon flashes."
Ooh, we're going to meet the worms this chapter.
I know. Yeah, it'll be exciting.
So for me, I took a different direction from both of y'all. I chose a relatively normal-sized chunk of quote. I chose from Jessica. She said, "One could be alone out here," she thought, "without fear of someone behind you, without fear of the hunter."
And she's proven wrong rather quickly, right?
But we'll see.
We'll get to that when we get there.
We'll discuss it there.
Yep. All right. Cool quotes, guys. And now we'll dive into the bulk of the chapter.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we start off in the point of view of Paul this time. And he starts off by beginning to scan his surroundings. And he really wonders if there's any Fremen living around in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I wanted to read this description of their landscape, which I thought was nice. And there's a lot of cool imagery in this chapter, so you know we'll be reading a lot. But here's the first one. "Folds upon folds of dunes spread beyond their shelter. Away from the setting sun, the dunes exposed greased shadows so black they were like bits of night. And the flatness. His mind searched for something tall in that landscape. But there was no persuading tallness out of heat-addled air in that horizon. No bloom or gently shaken thing to mark the passage of a breeze. Only dunes and that distant cliff beneath a sky of burnished silver blue." Wow. So it's really pretty in a homogenous and eerie way. I feel like it's this kind of dark deserty landscape and the terrain. It's, you know, very, you know, homogeneous and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really find it amazing how Herbert really uses like distance, color, texture, shape to just paint the world of Dune, especially. Because I want to start implementing this into my own writing, because just like how he uses like these four different, I guess, aspects of something really creates such a vivid environment within a reader's mind.
Mm-hmm. Right. He kind of appeals to your senses, which is what you want.
Yeah, it's very, you know, you're very like immersed into the book, I feel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice. I love this imagery. I mean, a lot of times I read books just for the wording. So yeah, so it's really nice to see.
Especially here for Dune, where we know the plot pretty well.
Yeah, well, I don't.
I mean, well, like it kind of foreshadows a lot of it.
True. So. Yeah, true. I have a good guess of what'll happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these writers are amazing. It's like they paint a picture, except with words.
Yeah, and even though the plot is kind of not revealed, but even though, you know, it's been spoiled a lot, I feel like you're still surprised, and that's a work of like a master's work, I feel like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How to be able to craft this plot so much that you know all of it, and yet, you know, every time it surprises you. Yeah.
That shows its skill rather than like luck. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Okay. So moving on from that. So soon after, Paul, like while Paul is scanning around the surroundings, Jessica awakes and sees Paul's stance, which reminds her of Leto. And I thought this was interesting because I thought Jessica let go of these feelings during the sandstorm, but I guess they came back, or maybe she just had some residual feelings left.
I mean, to be honest, I feel like she's been so caught up in all the action that's been going on, in the whole escape and running across the sands, that she hasn't really given herself the proper amount of time to heal from like some tragedy like this. Mm-hmm. However, also just like, does someone ever really come back from such a big tragedy of like losing someone who's like their husband or like their close partner? I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I was going to say not quite a husband, but they had a really, really close relationship, and especially for someone like Jessica, who has such perfect control of her faculties, you know, this wound must really sting. It must be really massive. Yeah. If she can't keep these thoughts out of her head in kind of this time where she can't really afford to be thinking about the past, right?
So yeah, she needs to keep moving.
Yeah, always looking ahead, and you know, it's, and we know, you know, Jessica and Lito had been, well, not married, but they'd have been together for about 16 years, right? So longer than Paul's been alive, that's for sure. And and yeah, so definitely that would be a devastating loss. And you know, we sympathize with Jessica, but from a logical standpoint, and emotions are never logical, but I feel, you know, that she also knows, I think, that you know, yeah, she can't afford to be dwelling on this too much.
In these situations, right, emotions are needed to be put aside so you can keep surviving to feel your emotions later on.
True, yeah. True. And this isn't the first time, too. You know, it's been multiple times she's had kind of these thoughts pop up. And I feel I've also talked about this before, I think, in the podcast. But yeah, so, you know, this kind of repetition just goes to show the extent of the relationship, I feel like. Yeah.
Well, of course, it's also easy for us to say, like, oh, it should be better for her to stick to her logical instincts.
I know, but yeah.
Honestly, as a reader, yeah, we'll have the same.
Yeah, we've never experienced something like this ourselves. So
if I'm dating someone for 16 years and they die, I'd be, you know, devastated.
Yeah, I would be pretty devastated.
Yeah, I think all of us would be.
And, like, I'll be taking a 10-year, like, I don't know, retreat in the mountains or somewhere.
Yeah, be like Teddy Roosevelt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's...
Okay. Yeah, here we also see Paul having his own gloomy thoughts, just like wondering if the plants around that desert that he's been seeing are just there on coincidence, or if they're actually, in fact, like, there because there's water nearby. And so I was just thinking, like, I don't know how he doubts this, because at least from my knowledge of the desert, which I read from books and stuff, that, like, if there's a plant, there's got to be water somewhere. Like, a plant's either sucking something from underground, or there's, like, a way for it to obtain water from the air. So I feel like Paul's been a little too pessimistic that they're not going to run across one of the abandoned testing stations. And he just needs to be a little more positive in this regards.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, this is pretty promising and confirms kind of what Gurney said last chapter, right? That there's greenery and raucous if you know where to look. So now, you know, Gurney's slightly vindicated, and he's probably done some flyovers and stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm sure they've seen patches of green, and it's it's nice to see that there's some plant life.
Yeah.
I like California.
I know, it's one of my friends just moved, actually. She just came to California, back to Houston. It's been, I think, like 4 or 6 years since I've seen her, but she was talking about how, you know, she likes Houston so much because when you drive around, there's actually green. And no offense to y'all Californians, but
it's brown out there.
But yeah, so I was driving from LA to San Diego, and all, you know, it's just, you can't see a single piece of vegetation. It's,
I
just
learned
all,
so many colors of brown when I was there.
For it's just shades of red, hues of brown. It's just, it's crazy. I mean, yeah. So
I don't know.
Yeah, that's really crazy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we get to my quote, which is quite early on in the chapter, and it goes, "How the mind gears itself for its environment," she thought, and she recalled a Bene Gesserit axiom. The mind can go either direction under stress, toward positive or toward negative, on or off. Think of it as a spectrum whose extremes are in consciousness at the negative end and hyperconsciousness at the positive end. Mm-hmm. The way the mind will lean under stress is strongly influenced by training. Uh-huh. Okay, so this quote is especially true because we're right about to go back to school, and it's actually, for us, it's tomorrow, actually.
Yeah.
And we'll have to train ourselves to deal with the terrible stress of homework and tests, and just thinking about it gets me stressed, and not in a positive way.
Honestly.
I don't know if I can go to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, I did hear it's super important to not only know that things will be okay, because I know, like, everybody knows that eventually, like, if they fail a test, like, people know that you're probably going to still, like, be alive. You're probably going to move on. You're probably going to do decent, you know? It's not going to be, like, life-ending, you know? But you have to actually believe this knowledge that you have. This is why I know it's quite popular for a lot of therapy and counseling sessions that they use this thing called positive reinforcement, where you, like, repeat, like, this positive phrase until, like, I guess you internalize it or something. Honestly, I've heard, like, a lot of contradictions of, like, how effective this is. But it's, like, the thought that counts, right? It's, like, believe what you know. So, like, it's not just like I know it, but, like, actually, like, live according to my knowledge, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think someone should develop one of those personality tests or whatever to see if you lean towards unconsciousness or hyperconsciousness, right?
Yeah, it's like a fight or flight.
Yeah, on the spectrum. But I think instead of describing the spectrum as stages of consciousness, you know, unconsciousness, of course, being no consciousness and hyperconsciousness, you know, pretty self-explanatory. I think it's more effective to describe it on some scale of maybe giving up versus persistence, right? And the way the mind leans is influenced by your own personal resolve and drive. And as Jessica said, your training and how much experience you have in these situations, right? Partly that's training, but partly also that's kind of the environment you were born in and your genetics and all of that, right?
Also, like some people, like they run initially, but then they gather the courage to go back in. So I find that's all right as well, in my opinion.
Right.
As long as you do it.
As long as you go back. So I also got to my quote quite early because I thought Jessica said something pretty cool. So I just want to talk about Jessica's quote. So one could be alone out here, she thought, without fear of someone behind you, without fear of this hunter. So it's one of those strange thoughts when you're like alone, I guess. One of those things where you're just like, I'm all alone. So for many people, alone is like one of the biggest fears that they have in their entire lives, other than the fear of failure. A lot of people also the fear of heights, but alone is like a massive thing that people are scared of, right? There's like, I'm no one to talk to. Humans are like social creatures, so being alone is like truly detrimental to our social aspect. In a way, though, Jessica looks at it in a different angle. She's like, I guess if you're alone, you're the only one around, which means that you're free from society, right? In that manner, it is quite freeing in a sense. But it's like you're picking your poison, right?
Yeah, it's
Like,
not
would
really
you rather
accurate.
like be alone or be like, I guess in Jessica's case, hunted by the Harkonnens and everybody else for having Paul. So I don't know. I guess she chose her pick. Well, I guess she was forced into her pick. I'm not really sure. But she's trying to
Yeah.
be positive in this scenario.
Yeah, personally, if I had to pick, I would rather be alone forever, but it's picking two poisons. It's none of them. You know, you're dead both ways. And solitary confinement, it's always been such a painful experience. And I mean, even the Puritans thought it was inhumane. And you know, minor history lesson here. So keep in mind, the Puritans were the people who ran the Salem witch trials, and they were the people who would test if you're a witch by tying some like a 20-pound rock maybe to you and throwing you into the river. And if you drowned, then you weren't a witch, but you're dead. And if you somehow managed to take off the rock and come back up, you were a witch, and then you get killed anyway. So
Oh,
you know,
wow.
so it was terrible. Yeah,
What a
so
fallacy.
I know. I don't know how they don't think of this logical fallacy,
What?
but right. So just keep in mind, the Puritans thought it was bad. And
Yeah,
keep in
and the
mind what the
Puritans tend
Puritans
to like
said.
live a minimal lifestyle as well. They, if you can't show public affection, you can't do certain things, you have to wear certain clothing, like cotton clothing, I believe.
Right, attend
Yeah.
church and all that. And
Modesty is a
yeah.
big thing for Puritans.
Yeah. So I don't know. So I would pick being alone, but it's a massive punishment. And I kind of disagree with Jessica though, that you know, that there's always someone behind you. Now there's no one behind you. I know she's talking about people, right? But here in the desert, you'll always be hunted by worms,
There's always
especially
something.
if you're like Paul and get tired and step into a drum sand, right? And more abstractly, they'll always be hunted by thirst. They'll always be in need of water, right?
Yeah, she's just, I feel like she's having a short-sighted moment here where she thinks that she's gone, but she just found, it's like jumping out of the pan into like the burners, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, out of the frying pan into the fire kind of thing.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I'm bad. I screwed up
it's okay.
that. That
Yeah, it's
was so bad.
okay. Yeah.
So for me, also throughout the book, there's this motif of the night sky and stars being used repeatedly by Herbert in order to zoom out to like a much bigger picture, right? We see that there is like a symbol of release from the current strife. And it's just nice to see Jessica having kind of a symbol of release from everything, right? A nice break to see the terrible beauty of doom.
Yeah, I know. It's a really great way to describe it because it's a taunting escape, but they'll never leave Dune again. So they're always really stuck here because of the spice and everything. So, you know, they can reach out and touch the cosmos, but yeah, I mean, it'll never be there. I mean, they'll never be there. Sorry. Yeah. So that's really cool.
Okay, so Paul uses a thumper at the deepest part of a crevice to buy around 30 minutes of time until a worm comes. And I didn't really understand this, and I was wondering if it meant that it'll take 30 minutes for a worm to get to them, or it'll take 30 minutes for the thumper to go off, which attracts a worm. And I'm guessing the latter because it just makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. How I can interpret it is like when he lights the candle, which I thought of it as like a long fuse or like a wick, it'll take 30 minutes for it to like burn through all of it and then activate the thumper to call the worm to like ensure their safe passage when they cross the open sands.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what I kind of imagined too. I don't think I have anything to add to that, right? It's just something burns away. And yeah, so it's weird because I expected they would have some sort of fancier technology. But you know, they're still stuck lighting a fuse. Isn't a fuse basically just a rope? Yeah, so they're still stuck.
It's just like a twisted rope, yeah.
Yeah, so they're still stuck lighting that, and yeah, so that's just kind of
it's a little primitive.
But I mean, the Fremen are surprisingly, sometimes they're surprisingly primitive, and sometimes they're just surprisingly advanced technologically.
It's just like how situational it is and how limited their resources are, so they divert their resources to like I guess more survival stuff, and just this stuff they just never failed to like, they never invested enough time into it, I guess,
right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, I wanted to discuss the quote, like, the night is a tunnel, she thought, a hole into tomorrow, because for Jessica and Paul, I think that the nighttime really does decide their continued survival, so it really is like their gateway to a like to their next day. So because they sleep during the day in order to conserve water, energy, and like their resources, right? However, then they have to work at night, which is super important because as whatever they do in those short like hours really guarantees if they'll make it throughout the next day. Because throughout the next day, they face everything like the heat, the dryness, the sands, the winds of the desert, and it's just they need to make as much use of their time while they're moving as they can.
Mm-hmm. Right. They mentioned they would have to travel during the night. It was a few chapters ago, right? But it's the only time they can move, so they have to optimize that time. And more metaphorically, the line between today and tomorrow literally happens at night. So I guess it's more literally, but I suppose the metaphor is that it's a symbol of continuous change. So the night is the time that things change, and you know, they keep moving throughout. Yeah, so it's really nice. At least, you know, we were just talking about Jessica being stuck kind of in the past with, you know, her memories of Leto and all that she lost as an Atreides member, but yeah, it's good to see that they still keep their progress in mind.
Yeah, Jessica's always got the Bene Gesserit training to back her up in these situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right,
she's got to keep moving on. It's just all she can do right now. Okay, so we finally get to see a real example of how the Fremen move through the sand. And apparently it should sound like the natural shifting of sand or like the wind. And from the book, it says it's supposed to sound like, or it is an unnatural broken pattern. And it sounds like step, drag, drag, step, step, wait, drag, step.
Ooh, yeah, I really liked how Herbert wrote this part because just writing out the onomatopoeia of the steps to really emphasize the lack of pattern and how abnormal it is to us.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so hard to do, especially controlling yourself so perfectly so that you don't move a single muscle incorrectly in order to mimic these natural desert sounds. Especially crossing the open desert like that, you can't just mindlessly walk. You have to use your brain and think about exactly what move you're making next. And you have to constantly focus on creating the sound that you need. And no wonder Jessica and Paul are so tired and their limbs are so exhausted. It's not just a physical thing. It's also in the head, you know?
Yeah, because like, I find that every single time you try to think you're doing it randomly, you actually start falling into a pattern after like a long while.
Right, yeah. So
it's so weird.
Yeah, I mean, people are only, we're not even good enough to be called pseudo-random. We're very predictable, honestly, as creatures. And you know, you could, you know, predict. I mean, there's a whole video I saw, I think it was a Numberphile video, on people predicting each other's rock, paper, scissors, and there was a formula or something. It's like, oh, if they play rock, the next turn you should play scissors, and then, or you know, you should like go backwards along the circle or something. It's really weird, but basically, you know, humans are predictable, and I'm sure the sandworm will notice. Yeah.
All right, so 30 minutes is up, and the thumper finally goes off, and a massive worm begins to make its way to their location. Mm-hmm. And the imagery here is absolutely terrifying and butt-clenching. Mm-hmm. You can almost imagine that it's right behind you. And to give you guys an idea of what happens, I'll read a certain scene from the book. It goes, "The sound, when it came, started so low that their own dragging passage masked it. But it grew louder and louder out of the west. Lump, 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 drummed the thumper. The hissing approach spread across the night behind them. They turned their heads as they walked, saw the mound of the coursing worm. Keep moving, Paul whispered. Don't look back. A grating sound of fury exploded from the rock shadows they had left. It was a flailing avalanche of noise." Wow. Honestly, Herbert is just showing off his writing skills.
He's flexing hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he really knows how to build anxiety and suspense into the story.
Uh-huh. Honestly, there's so much going on in this entire moment right now. All these different sounds, everything. There's so much action, right, in this entire scene. The sandstorm heading towards them, Paul and Jessica running into drum sands, and then them trying to do their friend and walk through this entire thing. There's just so much going on. And just the dialogue, the sounds that Herbert writes, it's so good.
Yeah, they contrast. I noticed when you read, lump, 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 you can feel this pulse, and then Paul's, his whisper, it's like a super nervous whisper, and then you just hear this boom, and then the worm appears, right? And it's so well described. I can't wait until, was this scene in the movie, Fillmore?
Yes, it was.
Okay, all right. I'm
excited.
Oh my, I cannot wait. Well, I mean, we're probably on track to finish around January. So 5 more months, and we'll watch them. I'm so excited. I heard it did a great job of visuals. So yeah, but it's a lot to take in. I agree, and they're in massive danger yet again. I feel like this is another one of those things that Herbert could have not written, and the plot would be pretty similar. But yeah. I think Herbert is still trying to build the drama and tension here. So
yeah,
that's why I included something. And I mean, I'm all for it because, I like reading these super imagery scenes. So the visuals are just incredible. I can't wait to see the movie again.
I'd rather have this than make it just be another scene where they just walk across the sands doing nothing.
Me too. Honestly, I prefer it over dialogue.
It's just step, drag, wait, step for 10 pages. Yeah, it's nothing else other than step, drag. That's what it would be.
Also, some small details that Herbert pays attention to, especially this one small detail of Jessica and Paul finding it difficult to not move on rhythm with a dumper, because it really, I guess for me, it just shows how Herbert's accentuating Jessica and Paul's inexperience in the movement, but also just how much mental stress they're going through. So it's kind of relatable to me because it's when I'm trying to sing in harmony, but because I don't actually take choir in school or anything regularly, but only for church. It's I stand too close to people from the other sections, and it's just super hard to not mix up your notes with theirs. I just find it so hard to stick to my row.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know you did choir. You should sing for us sometime.
No, only in church, guys. No, I'm not a good singer. It's only when I have to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I agree, though. I know for one, it's really hard to play different rhythms from others. And also, singing, I'm not so familiar with, but I imagine it's also really hard. And I mean, Fillmore, you could probably vouch for this in orchestra since we're both
100%.
Since we've both played an orchestra a bit. It's so hard to tune out the rest of the sections and focus on your own playing, and also you need to tune in the rest of the sections to be able to hear the overall ideas that that you're trying to play. And
it's so weird.
Yeah,
who do you adjust to? Your do you keep it original, but then when the rest of your team is going off track, do you adjust to them or keep it?
Well, you're supposed to adjust to others, but because if you're the only one that's behind while everybody else is speeding up, then
I guess
you'll be offbeat.
You
have to stay together. That's the whole point of the orchestra.
I just remembered when I played soloist with an orchestra once, I just followed the conductor. Teacher told me to just follow the conductor because I think the orchestra will always somehow come back to the conductor.
Yeah, that's but fair.
Yeah, so I'd rather be with the conductor, I think, than just kind of I don't know. I'm not an experienced soloist though, so maybe there's other things I need to learn. Right. Yeah, but it's especially hard for Paul and Jessica since they're exhausted. So not even they can't help but kind of fall into the rhythm. Yeah. Yeah, so really cool. But so my quote of the week, I took this iconic imagery, and this is, you know, really iconic for a reason that Phil will explain soon. But it goes, its mouth was some 80 meters in diameter, crystal teeth with the curved shape of Chris knives glinting around the rim, the bellows breath of cinnamon, subtle aldehydes, acids. So that's the first chunk. Continue a few sentences down. The worm drew back onto the sand, lay there momentarily, its crystal teeth weaving moon flashes. And lastly, a shudder passed through the worm. It drew further away into the sand. Only a mounded upper curve remained like half a bell mouth, the curve of a tunnel rearing above the dunes. Sand rasped. The creature sank further, retreating, turning. It became a mound of cresting sand that curved away through a saddle in the dunes. Wow, so yeah, it's really long, but I had to read it all since so far it's our most close-up glimpse at these fascinating creatures. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that this scene is the cover picture for most Dune books, as well as the cover for our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very special to us, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then this moment when they see the giant gaping maw of a sandworm after narrowly escaping from it, I think it's one of the most iconic moments of the book, if not the franchise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just at Barnes & Noble's, and just like the other day, I just kept seeing so many different Dune covers and Dune books. I know the modern ones are shifting away from the whole detail of Dune books, like the Dune sandworms, because that's more of a classic take. But I really like the classic take, because I am, at least on my Dune book that I own at home, it has like the planet of Arrakis, I think a moon on the cover. But on the back, it's like, I really like the back the most. It's got like two massive sandworms like jumping out of the sand, like a elliptical type of like, what do you call it? Helical? I don't know. Like the DNA thing.
It was really nice. Double helix, yeah.
Like a double helix type of shape. It's really nice looking. And I just really appreciate how like Herbert Rice's entire thing, all these details and all these like sensory imagery hitting you here. While Paul and Jessica just like suddenly like, I don't know. To me, it just seems like they're having like the sensory overload, and eventually they just give up on this whole shuffling thing and they start sprinting because they know they're not going to escape if they don't sprint. It's just so funny to me.
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining. They just run. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Run for your life.
Give up.
Yeah. No more.
I think Dune should be considered as a classic book. Like, it should be up there with Tom Sawyer and stuff.
True. Yeah.
After it.
Honestly, I think, yeah, so far, you know, it's kind of got the qualities of a classic, but then again, most classics aren't massive series, and this is, so I'm not too sure what would define a classic, actually. That's interesting.
Who makes something a classic? I don't know.
Yeah, what makes it a classic, though?
Wait, isn't Anne of Green Gables also a classic? Yes. But it also has quite a few books.
Oh, really? Yeah, Anne of Green Gables is a classic. Yeah. Interesting. I'm not sure. I'll look that up. Actually, I'm curious. What makes books a classic?
The classical system.
Yeah, I think
in
the US. We need to add Dune to the classics list if it isn't already on there. Yeah,
right. We're breaking new boundaries, or old boundaries, I should say.
Watch out, Kill Mockingbird. We're coming for you.
Man, I mean, TCAM was good though. So
I didn't like the ending.
I thought it was pretty soft, and everyone's like, "Oh, it was so powerful." I was like, "Eh, I mean, like, come on."
Oh, I like TCAM. Honestly,
it was good, but like, you know, yeah, it was good.
I can't claim I understood all of it though. I read it. I was part of school in freshman year, so yeah.
I don't know. It just doesn't have the same feel. I thought it was gonna be more powerful, and then I read it. I was like, okay, I could see it, but like, not really.
I think most of the court scenes are pretty powerful. Maybe the ending is a little weak.
That's true. I did like the court scene. Those were the best.
The court scenes were good.
Yeah, those were
the best scenes.
Yeah, I think those were the most important anyway. Uh-huh. The rest of the book is kind of just growing up.
Development.
Yeah, but the court scenes were all a climax. And that was good.
Yeah. All right, moving away from the topic of classics.
Yep.
Uh-huh. So instead of feeling fear from the monster called the Sandworm, Paul instead gets high off of it. And his senses go wild. Because it literally says, instead of frightening him, the sensation of time darkness forced a hyper-acceleration of his other senses. He found himself registering every available aspect of the thing that lifted from the sand there seeking him. And I found this to be super ironic because his mother, who's right next to him, had the proper reaction of being scared for her life, and it takes her entire training to get herself under control. Or Paul's out here chilling like a villain and getting off to that feeling. Like, what a thrill seeker.
I know. Yeah. I mean, Paul really is on another level at this point. And like, if any of us were on Arrakis, we'd probably be like dead by now, or we'd probably be like,
we'd probably just like collapse on the spot and faint.
Definitely.
But to be honest, I just kind of like, I find it so weird because like, it was described as like a smell of cinema, and Paul notices like every single particle in the air. I wonder how much sensory like he's actually receiving on his end, because like, I know the cinnamon challenge is hard, but like Paul is just like breathing in this dust. It's like, it's coming up all around him after all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's another manifestation of his Bene Gesserit training and Kwisatz Haderach abilities. And this is really good to see, because last time there was an event like this, Paul's mind kind of just shut down in shock for a few seconds. And here, Paul kicks into overdrive. It's, you know, it's his CPU starts heating up and his fans start turning. It's just like the axiom we discussed. Paul is definitely on the hyperconsciousness end, which is, it makes sense since he's so powerful. But later, you know, when we meet some of our favorite desert group, his mind kind of shuts down again. So it's clearly something he still needs to work on. But
yeah, we've definitely seen promise of Paul tapping into this, like when he was like riding the sandstorm. I remember like he was able to notice everything. There's like a couple other instances throughout the book as well where he accessed it.
Yeah, also when he, you know, in the tent at the end of book one where he consumed too much spice, right?
And he was like, I think, oh my god, it's poisonous.
Yeah.
We can't leave.
Well, as he continues to get this feeling over and over again, he'll eventually get it under control and it'll become a powerful asset for him.
Yeah, right. Preferably he could just turn it on and off like the binary switch.
Yeah. Okay, so the worm that was chasing them is attracted by another thumper set up by the Fremen. But what I don't completely understand is, why did Paul set off the first thumper if he was going to use the Fremen way of walking in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, it kind of backfired on them. I'm pretty confused by that.
Right. So either the Fremen way of walking isn't perfect, and like Paul and Jessica just prefer like a surefire method of getting the worm like literally away from them by like distance, or maybe just like Paul and Jessica just aren't good enough at it yet. I don't really know, like, whether it's both or whether it's just one or the other. I'm sure that like, I just feel like maybe they just don't want to take any chances because they are in a pretty tricky spot, and they do take any chances, they're screwed. So I don't know. I guess that's why he did a thumper, just for safety.
I agree. Yeah.
Oh, I also wanted to like ask, like, do y'all think that the thumper is powered by, like, what do you think it's powered by? Because I can't imagine it being powered by, like, what we usually use, like, gas or, like, electricity, not water, you know, or any other renewable resources that I see on
definitely
the
not water. Yeah.
Not water.
They just straight up drink it, yeah. But I think it's some lithium power supply, because Paul broke one of the, I don't remember what it was, the compass or something?
Yeah, or something for the foam.
Yeah, and he broke a lithium kind of capsule for the foam. Yeah, so he did that to make the foam. And yeah, so lithium batteries. And I mean,
I should crack it.
I don't know if you want to do that. I think that's toxic, right?
You know, like the big, thick ones that you see in the science labs, like sitting there from like the 60s or whatever.
Yeah, I'm interested in what's in that. But
I wouldn't recommend opening those up.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend touching batteries, like opening batteries and stuff. I just use them. Yeah,
it's not a good idea. We do not commend those actions.
Indeed.
I'm so sorry.
Quick
guys.
Disclaimer.
Yeah, don't follow my suggestions on this podcast.
yeah, don't listen to Nolan. Yeah.
So we finally get to see some Fremen made items that show that they do indeed live in this area. And some examples of this are they find poles that show which way to go and shallow steps which help to make their way up an escarpment or something. And when they do make it to the top, they see a stunning scene of desert growth, which seems like a fairyland to them.
Also, like, I kind of see this natural desert thing. Like, I see it kind of like a cave type of thing where it's like they're able to keep plants in it because it's not direct sunlight. So it's like a natural, I don't know how to describe it. So I know like natural heat sink, natural like greenhouse. I don't know how to describe it. But it's something like that. That's how I see it as. I'm also really curious about what they mentioned. It was like this maker hook thing. I know that the maker is what the Fremen refer to the worms as, so I'm not really sure what they use the hooks for the maker, right? Because I don't understand. Mm-hmm. What would they be doing with the hook to a maker? Like, it's so massive, you can't really hook it for real, you know?
I just thought of this. Are they potentially Chris knives? I'm not sure. Because
for some reason, I thought they could be like grappling hooks. They'd
I thought they were like maybe the hooks like in Ender's Game, you know, in the battle school, in the arena, they would have those hooks to move around, right?
They just fly.
I don't know, because Paul is the one that calls them maker hooks, right? And maybe, Paul, yeah. I think, knows the Chris Knife term. So why doesn't he just call it Chris Knife? So I don't think it's a Chris Knife. But, like, you know, Chris Knives are, I guess they're hooked and they're from sandworms, right? So
yeah, there's the T.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure what Maker Hook is. No, we keep that in mind, too.
When I first read it, I thought it was like a fishing hook, where it's like, are they going to catch a sandworm?
Yeah. That's what I kind of imagined, too. It's just a fishing hook or something like that. And, you know, perhaps maybe like a grappling hook or the Ender's Game hook, which is essentially a grappling hook, right?
Also, personally, I don't really understand why Paul and Jessica are so worried of using artificial light, especially because just because all like there's nobody around, you know. It's like we're not being hunted, and I know for a fact that Paul and Jessica and all this thing haven't really seen the Fremen's true combat capabilities. We know that was mostly a Hawat thing, and maybe Gurney, maybe, I'm not really sure, but we also do know that they both can fight pretty decently. Paul's got training from Hawat, from Gurney, from like even his own father, right? While Jessica, we know, can hold her ground against many powerful people herself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're probably just being extra careful, I can imagine. And also in this wild place, who knows what they'd attract with the light? I mean, they'd stay under cover of darkness. Or
Yeah. I think it's just smart of them to play it safe, because it's better to be safe than sorry. I guess that's pretty cliche, but you know, it's pretty important in this case.
I mean, it's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And while they're camping, we get some imagery of a mouse getting snatched up by a ghostly gray bird. And I think this is quite the ingenious form of foreshadowing, because the Muad'Dib means a kangaroo mouse from the Arrakis desert.
Yeah.
And as we know, Paul is most likely the Muad'Dib. It's pretty much confirmed.
Yeah, from the graph and everything.
Yeah, which means that something unfortunate will happen soon.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised that Paul didn't catch this metaphor himself, but hey.
I mean, the bird is hunting the mouse, and Paul is being stalked right at this moment by the Fremen. So yeah, I mean, I can definitely see this metaphor happening. Yeah, it's a very short foreshadowing in that, you know, it happens very
it's quite instantaneous. Oh, well. The effect.
Yep.
Oh well. he had a bit of a warning. Mm-hmm.
And connecting on my point earlier about something unfortunate happening, we get our first encounter with the Fremen since meeting with Kynes. And like I predicted, they don't seem to be very friendly and instead want the water in their flesh.
I just find it really funny how Jessica's fears of getting mugged for their water is completely correct. As like the dialogue with the Fremen who come just confirms it right away. Also, I was just thinking that like the Fremen also, when they talk to each other, treated Jessica and Paul as like two regular humans that they encounter, and that there's no like fear of them at all. Like they're not scared, even though like Jessica and Paul might be powerful or anything. So I guess that just speaks to like how confident they are in their own abilities.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, also, something I noticed, the Fremen man's name, Still. So I imagine this is Stilgar that we saw all those chapters ago. Like
the big man.
Right.
I think so too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Possibly,
Stilgar. I want to hear
confirmation. We don't know many Stills.
Yeah, he was the point. For to remind our audience, he was the person that you know, spits at the Duke, you know, as a sign of respect, because water. Yeah, he offered up some of his body's water. Yeah, so that was, I don't even know what chapter, maybe chapter 6 or something.
It was really early on.
Yeah, but I mean, this definitely could be Stilgar, given all the plot twists. And if this is Stilgar, and if Paul could convince Stilgar that he's the Atreides Duke, he may be okay. But
yeah,
we're not sure. Yeah, I mean, maybe his father, you know, he has some legacy. Yeah.
He has some there's some name that he has to carry here.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Duke was a different person from Paul, and I think Paul may still have to prove his worth in a way.
I think that's definitely true. Like you know, the person that you had to deal with is gone. Yeah, his son's still there, but his son still needs to prove that he's worthy of your help, just like the father was worthy of your help, you know.
Especially because Paul's so young. He won't trust such a young person.
Young kid tells you that you got to help him like beat off like a whole war. That's not going to happen without proving, like, without inspiring you in some way.
Without proving that he's worthy of their help.
Mm-hmm. I know, right.
Also, I just want to know that when they dropped in on Paul and Jessica, we saw Paul stiffen up in this crucial moment when he was caught off guard. This is mainly because his Bene Gesserit senses and like the whole Kwisatz Haderach thing was not able to foresee this future. We've seen that this is a slight problem, maybe not problem, but we see that this is something that Paul wanted to fix because he didn't want to rely too much on this third eye or something. But we saw that this is one of those crucial moments where Jessica was like, telling him that he needs to train for it, because no matter how much talent or no matter how much innate skill he has, it's still not enough to like be able to have perfect self-control over himself. And we just see that even in the Dune world, talent is not much, like, it's not, you still need practice and just like put in the work to get your skills up to like the same level of experience as someone else.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's weird because he reacted fine to the worm, but not so much to the Fremen, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know which is scarier. I feel like they're equally scary in different ways. Mm-hmm. Right. But it goes to show that Paul still has some things to work on. And yeah, so he's not the OP protagonist that, you know, so many books fall into. Mm-hmm. So he's, you know, even though he is very overpowered, he still has, you know, his own personal flaws to work on.
Struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's good to see, I think.
Even as a prodigy, he still needs to put his prodigiousness into use, or else it's going to become rusty.
Right.
Honestly, yes. He just needs to keep those skills working.
Yep. Yeah, and improve upon them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Cool. Yeah, so that's about it. On that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Dune Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read to the end of chapter 30 and tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Dune Not Enter, Reddit @Dune Not Enter, Twitter at Dune Not Enter, and email us at DuneNotEnter@gmail.com. That is DuneNotEnter@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say, corrections. Did I get that?
Oh my gosh, you said it so well.
I know. Yeah, I'm a pronunciation legend. All right. I'm proud of myself.
Spelling the material.
Yep. Yeah, so if we made any mistakes, please don't hesitate in letting us know, and we'll gladly fix that for the next few episodes. Give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It'll only take a few seconds of your time. Just go and head over to one of those places, make an account, and click the 5-star button, because it's the only one that exists, right? But on a more serious note, it helps motivate us to keep creating content really for you guys. Does. And also, it on a technical note, it allows us to climb the charts so that we can spread our podcast to a wider variety of listeners. Yeah, so that would be very much appreciated, and we would thank you for that. Otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye.